that we were agreed on the amendments in concept.
Well, I'll accept the motion to do it in concept, and then we'll have to bring the material back for quick review by the committee.
And then we have to revisit it anyway, then. I guess it doesn't matter. I thought maybe you might want it just to go out. Why don't we just do it the other way, then?
All right. By the way, I did send a note to the to Mike requesting that the bill on the counselors.
Thank you. Be assigned here.
All right. I haven't gotten any.
I think we need to have some understanding of whether or not when they give us a bill, it's given just for hearing purposes, and then they don't want us to act until they give us further permission, or whether
I've got to assume that if a bill comes to the committee, it's in the committee, and we follow the Ways and Means rules that says every bill has to be reported out by
Good.
A subcommittee.
I agree with that. Makes sense.
Obviously, the co-chair may be persuasive with us about whether or not they think something would be done, but I think it's the decision of the subcommittee.
A few million here and a few million there.
I think there was a rule change also that clarifies that, so we can do it that way.
Okay, any further business?
Just a comment, Mr. Chairman, since this is going to be coming back to us, and that is that I'm still having some very difficult time with this bill and its concept. I'm not particularly concerned very much about the budget, although I think there's some problems with that in relationship to it, but I think that the what's laid out here isn't going to work. And so I need to have some more discussion, I guess, with
Well, you want to have more teeth?
Well, I think you've laid out, yes, I do. I don't think there's anything in here to really invoke this to be useful to what you're intending to do. I think we're moving towards a different, towards getting third-party reimbursement concept. I think that's what this is about, and that's fine. And how we're going to get there and how they're going to make that determination is yet to be seen. I think there's going to be some more costs in the budget for setups on this thing. The APA allows anybody who, you need 15-day notice in that, you get a 90-day hold-off time. The board has to, in case anybody wants to contest that case, the timelines aren't right on it, and I think those issues need to be discussed. I'm surprised the bill got to us in this form, having gone through the substantive committee, and I've just got some problems with it. I'll talk to you guys about it, but if it comes back, I'm a no-go right now, so you know.
I think it would be very helpful if you would do that so that when we come back with it, we might be able to take action.
Right. I would remind Representative Peterson, or Representative Burton has not That's really Peterson. Been, I understand, has not really been involved perhaps in this over other sessions, but we had bills that were far more strenuous bills that did a lot more, and in part because of the variety of opposition that was generated. It wasn't possible to get those bills through the legislative process. They specifically worked out a bill that they thought could make it through the process, and it doesn't do as much as they probably would like to have it do, but it's a start, and they can build on it into the future to protect the profession.
Was the big argument between the mandatory and the voluntary licensing in the past, Cliff, when you worked on it?
Well, it was also an attempt to define, before they were trying to define a nutritionist as well as a dietitian, and they moved out of trying to do that. They also had a kind of scope of practice which they were defining, which they're not doing now, and some other sorts of things like that, in order to remove some of the opposition so they can get the licensing in place. And then we'll see what happens later on in terms of what they need to make it more effective.
But sure, there's a group called naturopaths right now in which in that particular statute, the scope of practice of those individuals is not mm-hmm. defined. And there's a great war going on between the pharmacists and the naturopaths over
we
scope of practice.
That.
And I'm just a little nervous here about setting up something else that sort of has moved to the point of letting somebody come in under a licensing provision that doesn't really set us down, and later on some nutritionist group comes in and says, wait a minute, we should be able to carry, I don't know if it's possible, maybe, and it's not for this committee shouldn't be the one discussing this,
well, yeah.
really.
Well, this has been through, a statutory committee, and committee sent it on.
That's why it's difficult for me to say no, because I'm not having necessarily trouble with the budget.
There's a lot of difference here, though, Mike, so what you're talking about, the naturopaths and the pharmacists, do have a prescribed scope of practice.
Right. There's an attorney general's opinion that says that they don't.
Well, they don't want to accept it.
They conflict.
Yeah.
Mike, there's a difference.
I don't mean.
And this, that was the problem with this bill in the past, was the difficulty or the attempt to define scope of practice and get into all the problems. For instance, the question was, if you have a health food store and you have a clerk in it who's advising somebody, here's a good supplement, that might be involved in the scope of practice of a dietitian. But on the other hand, they weren't prepared at all to make that sort of definition. So it just became a labeling act.
Well, the other thing, too, is the national is really very precise.
I'm going to adjourn the subcommittee. I don't care.
I think that really is your scope of.
It is our scope of practice, right? And so that we do have a very defined one at the national level, so that the people who are licensed, the scope of practice and code of ethics is explicitly defined.
Yeah, it's very tough.
Yes, it's very tough, yeah. So in that sense, it is defined.
Well, you need to talk to Representative Burton and get him on board.
Okay, thanks. Well.
This is May 8, 1989, Ways and Means Subcommittee on Education, convening at 1:30 p.m.
Subcommittee has come to order. House Bill 3124. And you're going to lead off on this?
Yes.
Good.
I have some other witnesses. Would it be okay if they come in?
Oh, okay. Sure. Gather around.
That double wind down there today.
Yes.
You first want to explain why you're trying to mutilate this bill?
Yes. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Don Miner. I'm here on behalf of Oregon Manufactured Housing Association to speak in favor of House Bill 3124 and to propose some amendments. I'll get right to those amendments if you'd like.
Yeah, why don't you?
Basically, those amendments accomplish two things. They sunset the bill in 2 years so that the legislature can have another opportunity to look at this program to see if they want to continue it. And the amendments also impose a cap on expenditures under this program and then allocate the burden of paying those costs between manufacturers and installers. Manufacturers would pay 2/3 of the cost and installers would pay 1/3 of the cost. That particular amendment was put into the bill at the request of Representative McTeague, the sponsor of the bill and chairman of the committee from which it came.
You can explain why he didn't do it in his committee.
That was my question.
I'm sorry.
It's all right. He anticipated.
I believe that it was done after it passed through the committee so that the bill could move along a little bit faster. Mr. Representative McTeague should be here today to talk about it.
Yeah, we'd be interested.
Yeah. I think it was easier to amend it here than there. Sounds that way.
Is this saying any of the votes? Is it?
If I could, I'd like to briefly describe the bill, and then I would have the others guests here to talk about it. With me today is Ann Robbins. She owns Central Homes in Woodburn. Her company is the second largest dealership in the state of Oregon. To my right is Don O'Rourke. He's the general manager of Fleetwood Enterprises in Woodburn. They're the largest producer of manufactured homes in the Northwest, and his company is, on a national basis, is the largest producer in the country. Wow. His factory in Woodburn produces about 5.5 double-wide homes per day. Basically, our association is comprised of dealers, manufacturers, and service people, those that provide the services to the industry. And over a period of years, we've come to see that the improper installation of manufactured homes is the number one problem facing our industry today. In the old days, these homes were basically single-wide trailer houses. It didn't take a great deal of skill to set those up. Basically, it parked them, blocked them up in the air. But today, the home has changed substantially from that older home. They're mostly about 88% double-section homes. They can weigh up to 40,000 pounds. They're completely engineered structures, and it's a complicated task to put them together and put them on the foundation that was engineered for them. Most times the home is put together properly and everything's fine, but all too often the homes aren't put together properly. And Building Codes Agency, HUD, the Builders Board, and I think even Jan Margosian over at the Attorney General's office recognizes improper installation of manufactured homes as our number one problem, something that needs to be solved. What we're doing in this bill is requiring that installers be trained to install the homes. They'd have to do this on a continuing basis. They'd be licensed as well. There's also a one-year warranty in the installation of the home included in this bill. I believe that's in Section 5. This bill is part of a larger attack on this problem. Basically, we're rewriting the setup standards to make them more rigorous. We're going to require that local inspectors also be trained in the proper inspection of the installation of a manufactured home, and that's being done by rule. And finally, we're requiring that the installers themselves be trained and licensed.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Do the installers want to be licensed?
Some do want to be licensed. The definition of installer is broad enough that it would include mobile home dealers as well,
okay,
who act as contractors for the installation.
Most of them do want to be
yes.
licensed.
Yeah, this is the policy of our association, and we have some installers in it.
But there are independent contractors who install, and they may or may not want to be licensed.
In the Business and Consumer Affairs Committee, we'd had an installer who works for the largest dealer in the state, and they requested it. Their concern was the cost. Initially, the bill, left the whole burden of the cost on the installers themselves. I think that was their reluctance.
Mm-hmm. What happens in a small town who may not have somebody who wants to either go through the training or does only a few of these maybe a year, doesn't warrant going through the training, when that would be then rely on the manufacturers to supply the installer or the installation aspect of it?
Yes.
I'm Donald Roy. One of the very problems is that we do not want to have that guy with the saw and the hammer and the chisel and the crowbar and bulldozer in some cases pushing that together, doing that work. This is a very costly item to us. We're spending somewhere around $1,000 a house in the industry to put our house together, because we think we've got a problem with setup of around two-thirds of that cost involved in that setup. Our state people who inspect our houses, and we put a lot of time and technical information in these houses, not like the old days, you build them until they fell apart and then you put another couple of two-by-fours, and that's what we had the reputation of doing. Now we go to a small town, we have these two guys setting up, or we have a dealer that comes into town that sets up and gets into business very easily, by the way. Takes a very good product, goes get the cheapest guy to set it up, and we have not only a bad installation, we end up with a bad reputation as far as being a manufacturer. And to let this guy to go in there and fool with a technical house that can fall down on bad setups or bad analysis of the property that he's setting it up on, it sinks, it shifts, is really criminal to it.
You have the prerogative, as you sell these directly to anybody, you would have the prerogative to sell, I won't sell your house unless we install it. That'd be one solution, right?
That's correct.
Now, they're through a dealer saying, I won't give you a dealership unless you use our installers. Now, why wasn't that approach taken?
I can do that.
Go ahead, you
can. Mr. Chairman, Representative Van Vliet, this industry isn't franchised like the automobile industry, so there is less control on the part of the manufacturer as to who will do the work. Essentially, they sell the homes wholesale to dealers. Dealers then contract out the installation of the home. Oftentimes, they're dealing with people that they don't know very well, independent contractors who may have greater or lesser skills. We attempted to to accomplish this same goal on a voluntary basis, the industry, through the Building Codes Agency, financed a series of voluntary training programs which were taken around the state. A number of people attended those programs, but all in all, it wasn't very successful. It appears that just a voluntary program isn't going to work. I think that's the pressures of the marketplace sort of cut against a voluntary solution to this problem.
That's the first time I heard the manufacturers didn't have control of the dealerships. You know, and normally most businesses, you got them by the throat. You either do a good job or you don't get the dealership. And here, the consumer is only going to pay for this. It's just a matter of when they pay for it.
Mr. Chairman, I think it's also a question of how much they're going to pay for it.
Okay.
We believe that under the current system, it's what, $400, $500, maybe $600 per house of repairs that are necessitated because of the improper installation. We think we can get those costs down to about $12 a house through this program, assuming that it works perfectly. This program, in essence, would cost $12 on a double-wide manufactured home if the manufacturer paid the whole cost. And we're not proposing that. We're proposing that the manufacturers pay two-thirds of the cost, that dealers and the actual installers of the home pay one-third of the cost. So we think that it'll be a considerable saving to the consumer. We also believe that it relieves some of the headaches that they have when things go badly for them.
By the cost, you mean the fees?
Correct.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Don, maybe I missed it when I first got here, but did you talk about what these folks have to do to get licensed? Do they just pay their fee, or is there a certain training program they go through, or what's...
Mr. Chairman, Representative Peterson, the details of that program will be worked out by administrative rule, but we envision a program of continuing education that in order to be licensed, a person would have to go through some level of training. There would probably be different levels of training. For instance, a person who just simply acted as a general contractor, who didn't actually do the work themselves, would probably go through less training. A person that was doing the hands-on work would go through more training. But there's an existing board that would regulate this program. It's called the Manufacturers Housing Construction Safety Standards Advisory Board.
Is that a state board or is that a private?
It's a state board appointed by the governor. It's comprised of local building officials. There are industry representatives on it. There are members of OSTA, for instance, are represented on that. Low income housing consumers are represented there.
So that board could basically set up the program.
Yes, that board would develop the details of the program.
Thank you.
Suppose it's still done wrong after you run your program. What recourse does the consumer have?
Section 5 of the bill. yes. Let's see if the engrossed, the part that we hand engrossed.
Take away the license.
It would be page 5 of the hand engrossed.
I don't have a hand engrossed copy.
Yeah. I think it was on the table separate.
Was it?
Look at the tail end of this.
Oh, here it is.
It's
on the table.
It's stuff.
Oh.
Okay.
Here it is.
Excuse me.
So we're going to have a copy. It'll be page 5, the page number up in the right-hand corner, lines 7 through about 17. If, Mr. Chairman, if something still goes wrong, the consumer within 1 year of the installation of his home would be able to complain to the state of Oregon that the home had been improperly installed. The state would notify the installer that such a complaint had been lodged, and they would go out and look. If they found that that home was not properly installed, they would require that the installer go back and fix it. If he failed to do that, he would lose his license. He'd not be able to engage in business any longer.
Well, that doesn't do the manufacturer any good because you have a bad reputation. It doesn't do the consumer any good because they won't get their house fixed.
Yeah, well, the installer... Well, then ultimately, we're back where we are today.
Okay, well, then we ought to change that, though, to to where the house gets back into, because the manufacturer's name and credibility is on the line if that doesn't get fixed. And manufactured houses now are better than stick-built houses in many cases.
Yes.
And what you're trying to do is build a reputation that is not going to be faulty out there because of a lousy installation. You're putting some of these on concrete foundations, I take
yes.
it. And often a lot of the foul-ups are basically because the concrete foundation has been put incorrectly by the person who's out there trying to install it. You roll up your house, you try to put it on, the foundation doesn't fit.
Yes. But again, we'd have a program of training. There'd be this warranty that's built in. There isn't.
Where's the warranty? You referred that to five, but it's not in five.
Well, and it doesn't. It's not an express warranty, I guess, but it
how
does
about
say.
A, how about a warrant? How about a bond?
Everyone performing this service will be bonded through the builder's board. So we will have the bond in place. This
do
is on top.
Action against that bond?
Yes.
Where is that in here?
I believe that's not contained within this law. That's just under the normal builder's board process.
Mr.
All of these
sub
steps.
Three of Mr. five.
Unless you've ever had a constituent go and try to put a lien against the builder's board bond, it means nothing.
That's right.
Absolutely. It's so minuscule that if you talk about a manufactured house, like we're talking about here, and if there's faulty design or whatever else in the installation, and you have a collapsed foundation or some substantial structural damage, that bond is a $100 bond. $100 doesn't even begin to cover the paperwork for what you start to apply for.
The builder's board bond that we're, that would apply here is a $5,000 bond. Now, ultimately, assuming that bond proves inadequate, the consumer has recourse back against the dealer and probably through Magnuson-Moss Warranty Act, for instance, probably on to the manufacturer himself. Our goal is to solve the problem earlier before it goes back up the ladder.
Well, we're talking about a situation which isn't solved, but is only resolved by withdrawing the license, but doing nothing about
Mr. Chair.
Reclaiming the cost. Senator Rowe?
Sub 3 of Section 5 talks about penalties. Are there civil penalties that the board can levy to get somebody who's an installer to wrap him on the knuckles and say, pay this amount and then go get it fixed?
Yes.
Pay more if you don't?
Mr. Chairman, there are civil, they do have power to impose civil penalties.
What is ORS 701-1992?
The Builders Board statute, I believe. I believe it is Builders Board statutes.
But I think one thing that we've concerned about, since you have a law here setting up for the first time the licensing and examinations and so forth of installers, what assurance do we have that this new licensing authority also comes under the building codes?
I'm sorry.
Penalties and so forth.
We've also included Section 8 in this bill, which I think is a good way to compel compliance. And basically it says that a person who doesn't conform, who's not licensed, can't collect for his work.
Yeah, but he's already collected. That was a year ago.
Oh.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
I think that's a real valid issue that the chair raises, Don, because under the builder's board, you know, I can go in there and post my fee and be licensed under the builder's board. I am then entitled to go out and take advantage of the public. Come back in, take bankruptcy, take whatever else. No way to go back and recover the damage that I caused under licensing by XYZ company. Set up John Smith Construction Company or Installation Company over here, post the new fee for the new bond, and bingo, I'm back in business. The senator is asking a very legitimate question. What happens when the installation has occurred? And all of a sudden, it's 2 years later, and because of ground fault, the ground was not adequately prepared, the foundation is tilting, and the modular units are beginning to pull apart, separation. John Smith just went out of business. And so they filed a lien against the builder's board as the sender asked. And the guy went belly up during the course of time and has went in and filed a new bond under a different name, out doing business. But do you know the builder's board can't touch that guy under his new name?
Absolutely. That's the problem with the builder's board.
You bet. Right on the nail.
I'm not trying to put you down, but I'm trying to point out the problem that the senator is raising. I think it's a real legitimate reason.
Mr. Chairman, senators and representatives, if I could go back just for a second, one of the things that is so important to us in the very beginning of the thing, particularly me as a dealer, is that I want to make sure that everybody who touches those homes has the proper training. And legitimately, I believe that a lot of the things that happen out in the field are not done intentionally. I think it's because Mr. Smith's setup contracting company came from New Mexico because the market got soft there and it's going good here in Oregon. And they build them differently there than they do here. But because he has experience, all of the dealers that he goes to assume he knows what he's doing because he believes he does. Okay, but there's no training required of him to begin to do the work here in Oregon. It seems that without proper legislation, some kind of ruling that says you're not allowed to do it until you've received the training, I think that would take care of a large percentage of the ones that are done incorrectly. Because I don't believe that it's always intentional. I think a lot of times it's lack of training. They just don't know how they're supposed to do it. It makes me as a dealer feel a lot more comfortable when we have an overload, let's say, of people that need to be delivered and set up. If I feel confident that the people that I get run in as a second set of contractors have received the same training as the people that I use on a daily basis, I'm more likely to hire them to do the work, thereby getting the consumer his house earlier than I would be able to normally. And as far as the penalties imposed, in my opinion, the dealer is always ultimately responsible if the consumer buys from me. I mean, I am ultimately responsible for that house, regardless of who I hire to do the work. If there's some way to make sure that everybody's trained, it will keep people from buying houses and just using anyone.
But you're responsible until you go bankrupt. If you're not around, that consumer. Now, for the last 25 years, I've been trying to convince students in class that manufactured homes were different than prefabs. Right? The public still doesn't understand that. Mm-hmm. They don't understand that they've got insulation and kiln-dried wood, and they're probably better than stick-built. Now we get out there and we get into what Lynn's talking about, and that is you get a center foundation collapsing on you, inside intermediate support folding under you, your refrigerator slides halfway across the room, your floor falls apart. And who's to blame? This is the homes that are going to be around in the future because people can afford them, Frank. They can't afford 200 grand houses. They're going to be moving into manufactured housing because it's economical. This will be the medium and low-cost housing in the future for a lot of people. Now, I've got to guarantee the consumer, basically, that they're going to be protected. Now, I don't know if you could take out a bond even, and I'm not even sure if all of a sudden you went bankrupt that consumer is protected, nor is his reputation protected.
Yes. Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Representative Van Vliet, you're describing the present situation with all builders. Manufactured home dealers, builders, are regulated this identically to conventional builders. Except they also have another bond. Dealers have a dealer bond for another $15,000. Seems to me that the consumer is probably better off dealing with in the manufactured housing side of the housing business than the site-built side. You're dealing with people who have generally more capitalization. Fleetwood, for instance, I think grossed over $1 billion last year. And these are very large companies where at least the person that built my house shortly thereafter, it was a site-built house, went broke and moved to Alaska. I don't know where he is now, probably went on to Texas. I still don't know where he hid the transformer for the doorbell. At least with the manufactured home, you're dealing with a house that's totally engineered, including the foundation. You're dealing with very large companies that are producing these homes, and fairly substantial companies who are acting as dealers of the homes. You may decide...
But I could be dealing with three people here.
Yes.
An independent installer, a dealership, and the manufacturer. In stick-built house, I've got the contract.
It turns out that you're better off, though, at the manufactured home. The dealer, in fact, is the contractor. They act as the general contractor. They're the ones who hire the sub. And assuming the sub went broke or went away, as in your example, they ultimately have recourse, if his bond proves inadequate, back up the stream to the dealer's bonds by means of the contract they have with the dealer. They're more protected. I agree that there's probably some shortcoming in the Builders Board statutes. I don't know how you can't remove all risk from the marketplace.
Let's backtrack here, though. This bill only establishes the liability of the contractor, of the installer. It has no reference to the liability of the dealer.